VC versus PE, I feel like you can do so much more impact when you're scaling something from 10 to 1,000 employees than when you're just moving numbers at the later stage. And I feel the same way about investing in emerging countries where you're really moving the needle when you're bringing step change.
Hello and welcome to the INSEAD Emerging Markets Podcast, where we interview business leaders and emerging market experts on business innovations, market opportunities, and macro level trends in emerging and frontier market countries. Join us for the next hour to dive deep into the world of emerging markets as we speak with top performers who are successfully investing, working, and living in these markets themselves. Hello and welcome to this month's episode of the INSEAD Emerging Markets Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Lal, and today we are joined by Sanjay Zimmerman. Sanjay is the principal at White Star Capital. White Star is a VC firm that invests in emerging markets across the world with a focus on Southeast Asia. Sanjay is an INSEAD 20J, which he completed while he was setting up the Singapore office of White Star. His firm has invested in many exciting startups across Southeast Asia, including Flash Coffee, which was recently launched by another recent INSEAD alum. Sanjay, thank you so much for being here. I'm really looking forward to getting to know more about you. I've done a bit of research and I've seen that from a young age, you were traveling the world, interviewing entrepreneurs, you started your own business in college, and then went into investment banking in the UK before you became the successful venture capitalist that you are now. So I was wondering if there was one point in your life when you realized that VC is the path that you wanted to take and this is the sort of work that brings excitement to you.
For sure. First of all, Nick, thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be on. And I really love always talking to fellow INSEAD alums. And I think it's amazing, the community, how large it is and how spread it is. Anecdotally, I was just sitting at our office having a meeting with another INSEAD founder. And someone walked up to us and said, "Wait, I heard Fonti. I am from the class of 09D. And so it's crazy. Wherever you are in the world, you bump into INSEAD alums, which is really awesome. But yeah, to your question on how I got into VC and my personal journey there, I first heard about VC or what venture capital was when I was a sophomore in college. I took this class called Raising Capital. And instantly when I took the class and kind of understood the basic premise of it combining finance with entrepreneurship, I thought, this is the career path for me and this is what I want to do. And then I knew then right away that I wanted to figure out a way to do venture. And I asked the professor who was teaching the class at the time, how do I get in and sign me up? And she told me there were two paths at that time. And it's changed a lot, but this was kind of old school advice that I got at that time was there's only two paths. One, you go into investment banking, you do a few years, and then you join a fund, or you become a founder, you have a successful exit, and you become a partner at another fund. Those are the two entryways. And so I took the more risk-averse route and went down the investment banking route, did a few years at Rothschilds in London and made sure to be placed in the TMT team, tried to work on as many tech deals as possible to build up as much relevant tech experience as I could to then have a good profile to be ready for venture. And then when the time came, I started looking around, talking to different firms in London, in the Valley, and stumbled upon this team at White Star Capital. It was a team of only about 3-4 people at the time that was split between London, New York, and Montreal, and had really good discussions with the two managing partners and founders of the firm. And I thought, there's not going to be a million chances in my life to be able to work at a global fund and go back to Canada where I'd grown up. And so I took the risk and joined the team in those early days when we were just raising our second fund. And I've been there now ever since for over 5 years. Actually, earlier this month was my 5-year anniversary with the firm. So it's been great. And you talked about, you know, the travels that I did. I spent, when I was in college, I spent quite a bit of time doing this documentary film series on discovering entrepreneurship in emerging countries. And it started out as a research question that I was talking to a few professors, and we were thinking about writing an essay on entrepreneurship in India initially at the time, and then branching out to South America and to Southeast Asia, Northeast Asia. But I thought if I do an essay, A, I'm not the biggest fan of writing essays, and B, I thought it's going to be great learning, you know, between myself and the professors are going to read it, and that's probably where the puck's going to stop, and there's not going to be much more sharing of those ideas and stories of those entrepreneurs beyond that. But if we do a documentary film series, because we're doing a podcast right now or doing a video, those mediums are really a lot more powerful to kind of carry stories across. And so did have embarked on that journey, ended up meeting over 60 founders across 9 countries. And it's also another, while I was doing this while I was in college, and I kind of had that early realization that kind of confirmed my interest in doing venture capital and in doing a career that related to talking to founders on a daily basis. And today I'm really happy to be able to think, you know, it's come full circle in some ways where I'm doing what I was doing when I was in college. Just instead of coming with a camera, I'm coming with the potential to invest, which is really awesome.
That's awesome. Did you learn anything from that documentary series that has been useful in VC now in terms of the questions to ask or how to approach entrepreneurs or anything else?
Yeah, I think it's really what was really helpful in traveling and going to different parts was really understanding also cultural subtext or the nuances wherever you go of how entrepreneurship is viewed. Sometimes when you're sitting in the US, you're sitting in a bubble of just thinking that the whole world is like Silicon Valley, and it's not in terms of mindset. Like there's the risk taking and how it's rewarded, and even failures, how they're viewed in different parts of the world, in different countries. Like we view in the US, people view entrepreneurs always as like, it's great and you fail and it doesn't matter. In other parts of the world, it's not the same. And that leads sometimes to risk aversion or different kind of behaviors and trying to understand and work through the cultural subtext of different founders that you talk to was a key lesson. I'll give you an example. When I went to Brazil, over there, a lot of people, they wish for their kids or the most cherished job is to work for the government in public service because it's a steady job. It historically has been just, that means if you get a job at the government, you've done it. But being a founder means you couldn't find a job. So there's this negative connotation around founders, around entrepreneurship. That was kind of back then in 2013, 2014, when I was there, that was starting to change. But it's interesting how these cultural norms have to change in somewhat for a good entrepreneurial ecosystem to start to be created. And we're seeing that. And so it gave me a little bit of these clues of what are the things to look out for and what makes an ecosystem a really good time for us to start to look at and invest and where the tides are starting to shift.
Sure. Yeah, that's really interesting. So when I met you at INSEAD, you were partially there, I think, to expand White Star's portfolio in Southeast Asia. Is there a reason that you decided to focus on that region? Were there any cultural characteristics or any other characteristics that made that region the one that you guys decided to make the focus?
Yeah, several. So I first spent time in Singapore in 2014 was my first time there when I was doing that project, and met with a few founders and spent a bit of time in Thailand as well. And I really fell in love with the region back then and always had this at the back of my mind that it's such an interesting place to be where the region as a whole is 700 million people. It's the size of Europe almost. It's larger than the US. And you've got, I think it really started in Singapore in 2012, where you had the highest mobile penetration rates of any country, and really a willingness and desire from individuals to be mobile first, to be tech savvy. So caused a really ripe environment for entrepreneurship, for tech to emerge. We're seeing the big macro phenomenon with the demographics being very favorable and the rising middle class. And so we thought it has all the ingredients of being a great environment to invest in. And on top of that, because you could say similar things for China and India, but those markets, A, are very large and they're very domestic or very insulated from themselves versus Southeast Asia, by nature of being more fragmented, there's already more global cross-border collaboration that happens. And so for a global cross-border fund like us, that fit really nicely. And there was a nice willingness from investors locally to work together with a global fund like us and co-invest on transactions. Whereas in India or China, for example, there are major local funds, there are major international funds that have been there for 15, 20 years plus. They're much harder markets to pierce. I think you need an AUM in the tens or 15s of billion to really go into markets like China and India successfully. Whereas Southeast Asia was still a little younger and a little more agile to be able to work with for a fund of our size. And it's been great. We've done 3 investments out of Singapore, 1 out of Malaysia, 1 in Hong Kong. And so our footprint in Asia has been growing. And so that's been a key market for us. Another key market for us for the similar reasons has been South Korea, where we've done 2 investments so far. And it's been great to keep growing into the region. We're formally moving in to some offices later this summer. So there should be a lot more announcements and things to come in the coming months.
Yeah, it's exciting. I mean, it's a very exciting region to be in. Things are opening up finally here. So I think the exciting growth we saw over the past few years can start picking up again, hopefully.
In terms of beyond geographies, are there any business models or technologies that you find most exciting right now, or companies that you've most recently invested in that you think have a lot of potential based on their business model?
Yeah, in terms of sectors, that, and we're a sector agnostic fund, so it changes over time. But recently, we've been quite excited just about everything automation related. And that means we've backed a company that helps kind of create and build your own full factory and assembly line. And so we've been thinking a lot about manufacturing automation as well as white collar job automation. That company was called Vention. They have a 3D CAD design platform where it's almost like if you use virtual Legos, like you can build, assemble your machine and then have it ordered to your factory within 2 days. And that's been revolutionizing the way manufacturing has been working. A lot of the EV companies that popped up in the last 2 years have used Vention to kind of order all their equipment and get their factories set up and ramped up and ready to go to market. So that's been great on the manufacturing side. Similarly, on the white collar jobs side, we've backed a company called Work, WRK, that what they do is they help with RPA and process automation. And both of these trends, why we like automation as a whole is because we're just seeing on a macro level, there's going to be a shortage in every industry, in every sector of talent. Mm-hmm. And without these tools, we're going to keep seeing higher and higher inflation because there's not going to be enough people to do the work that's needed to manufacture and to render services. And so we see these two solutions as kind of essential solutions for the future. Yeah, so that's been one. Business model-wise, we love the roll-up. We've been paying more and more attention to roll-up models. We've always appreciated roll-ups as a part of our M&A, as part of our even core portfolio strategy. So we've had companies like Clark and InsurTech in Germany that was rolling up old school brokers and bringing them into their new online digital brokerage platform. We've seen it with a number of our other portfolio companies being kind of a successful way to grow on top of organic growth, to do a few roll-ups of legacy companies in their industry. Mm-hmm. And most recently, we backed a company called Unibrands in Singapore that's been doing this on the e-commerce scale. So rolling up Amazon, Shopee, Lazada businesses, and just bringing in more efficiencies from scaling them together and running them as a large. Yeah, we're seeing it as really that's the model of like the modern day Unilever or Procter & Gamble, the modern day multi-brand firm will be made up of these kind of Amazon or e-commerce roll-ups.
That's really interesting. So I suppose with globalization, there was sort of the rocket internet approach of taking business models from the US or the developed world at least, and then applying them into emerging markets. But based on what you're talking about, it sounds like a lot of these new business models are just popping up in Asia or other emerging markets, Africa, and they may not exist in the US or the developed world. So I'm wondering, when it comes to your approach, do you care about validation of a business model in other markets before you invest? Or is it more just you look at the fundamentals of the business and you say, hey, this may be a new business model, but we're going to invest anyway because we believe in the business and it doesn't matter?
Good question. So the way I like to describe these days, the way that we think about making investments is we start from, it's almost like a funnel kind of approach. So we start at the top with deciding, you know, this is a new business model or this is a new sector or trend. Do we believe in that? Like, do we think that this fundamentally is something that makes sense and is worth spending time on? Then if we pass that gate, then the next step is, okay, if we believe that it's something that's exciting, then where in the world does this model have the most chances of succeeding? And so then that's the benefit of us having the ability to invest in Asia, Europe, and North America. We can kind of pick and choose which part of the world we want to focus on. And then once we've decided that, then with our local teams on the ground in each of these regions, we try to then identify, okay, what is now the best company in this region executing on this model to be able to back and invest? And that's exactly the approach we took when we did our first investment into an e-scooter business in Europe, into Tier Mobility. And we did that when we were looking at telemedicine here in Canada. And we did that when we were looking at the Amazon aggregator model. And it's really helpful to be able to not only decide if it's a right thesis or trend, but also decide where and then and which company.
That makes a lot of sense. Good. And you mentioned a bit about how you're looking at automation as a way to counter inflation. I was wondering how much macro trends like inflation, low interest rates, and so on, how does that affect your approach at White Star in terms of your investments? And are there any other effects beyond just the focus on automation that those may have?
Yeah, inflation, interest rates. I mean, the terrible human tragedy that's ongoing right now in between Russia and Ukraine, and a variety of these different macro factors that we've seen in the last couple of months definitely have a significant impact on the industry, because in the sense that they isolated by themselves, like they're only, you know, temporary macro drivers that shouldn't really have an impact on an investment when your investment horizon is 8 to 10 years. But in practice, what happens is that they tend to cause a lot of uncertainty in the markets. I mean, right now, what's been happening is the public markets have seen sharp drops, and that's led to uneasiness from the growth investors. Then it's almost interesting because this happened in December. Then in January, it started to trickle down to the earlier stage investors. By now, like, it went from growth to Series C to maybe now we're kind of starting to feel it across Series A and B, and it'll be seed and stage investors that'll feel it in the next month. And so that is a negative, and it's unfair and not great for founders. And we've told all of our founders at the start of the year, like, they when we started to see this kind of domino effect start to trickle in, that they should try to raise or ensure they have enough runway for the next few months. Because it causes this decision inertia across firms where nobody wants to make a decision because there's too much uncertainty about these variables, even though you could argue, you know, what is really the long-term 5-10 year impact of these variables. But it leads to no decisions being made. It leads to processes being dragged out. And ultimately, it leads to companies that are looking to fundraise for a typical fundraise that would take 1 or 2 months being extended into multiple months. And it's not just the fact that it's extended, it's all that uncertainty. And that's not great for founders and for any kind of job. So it has this indirect impact that in the end has a pretty significant impact on the industry, even though if you're sitting in a classroom and trying to pull threads at what it should matter. I mean, the only thing when you think about inflation or interest rate, the only thing that it should matter that that means your discount rate's higher. That means your DCF valuation, your future earnings growth is worth less. And so, sure, there should be a small impact on valuation that you could price in, and everyone moves on, and you're kind of good to go. But the reality, the practice, is that it's not just the mechanics of that happens. It's the uncertainty, and it's the lack of decision making that happens, and then it's the that causes then even more harm than it should.
Sure. Have you seen it impacting VCs raising their funds at all, or is it mostly just deploying capital into the startups?
Right now, it's more been deploying capital. A lot of funds have a lot of dry powder, and they've just been slower at deploying it in this uncertain environment. And that means they're also not going back to market as quickly to raise new funds. So we're not seeing it just yet, but the economic or portfolio allocation theory would say that if these public equity market values remain low, it's going to impact the deployment into VC, because the model is that, you know, if you have an investment statement that says 10% of my allocation of my AUM is going to alternative assets, then if your pie suddenly is smaller, that 10% is smaller, which is also something that I did the CFA, and you learn all these kind of things in there, but it's theoretical, but it doesn't make sense, because this is the best vintage to be investing in VC when there's a downturn. And so you should be raising your allocation to alternative assets if you look at the historical data. But but again, there's always the theory, and then there's the practice of how people behave in these types of environments. And so for sure, it's going to impact the amount of money that's going to go into the industry in the next year or two.
Yeah, that's really interesting. The human element is there at every level of the decisions in this process, it seems like. Yeah, unfortunately, I'd love to continue. We're running a bit short. So I guess just one final question. What is your why? What makes you get up in the morning? What makes you excited about what you do?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, personally, I've been very lucky to get to where I've gotten to in my career. I came as half German, half Indian, but came as an immigrant to Canada. I grew up, you know, middle-class family. I was very lucky to get scholarships to go study at boarding school here in Canada, and then in U.S. at Babson got funding to do this whole project to meet entrepreneurs while I was in college, thanks to the Wiseman family. And so I feel that I've been really lucky to be where I am today, and owe it to all those that kind of supported me to get here to do something big and to make a positive dent in the universe. We didn't get to talk much about why I'm also really passionate about investing in emerging economies, but in a nutshell, it's just the same reason why I got into VC. versus PE, I feel like you can do so much more impact when you're scaling something from 10 to 1,000 employees than when you're just moving numbers at the later stage. And I feel the same way about investing in emerging countries, where you're really moving the needle when you're kind of bringing step change with some of these companies that you're backing, and the social economical impact that these firms end up having, which we've seen, and that's something that I'm really passionate about.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the INSEAD Emerging Markets Podcast. To stay up to date on events we may be hosting, emerging market news, and to build your personal network, please feel free to join the INSEAD Alumni Emerging Markets Interest Group on LinkedIn.